From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Massacres in Iraq. Haditha and Hamandia will speak with the reporters breaking both stories, then how the press rolled over for Bush. We'll talk to media critic Eric Bowler about his new book, Lapdogs. And finally, three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas Friedman on petropolitics, war, and globalization. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A European diplomat on a visit to Tehran says he's making progress in talks over Iran's nuclear activities. The diplomat, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana, is in Iran with a package of economic and political incentives to persuade Iran to give up its domestic uranium enrichment program. He spoke Tuesday after meeting with lead Iranian nuclear negotiator Ali Larijani.
We had a very good meeting with Dr. Larijani and with the minister now. I think the atmosphere was very good. We are going to try to continue. The government and the leaders do have a proposal presented by a group of countries, the European countries, the Russian Federation, the United States and Russia and China. And I hope very much that we will have soon an answer. And we would like very much to continue working and see if we can achieve a good agreement that would be beneficial for everybody.
The incentive package was drawn up last week by the five veto-wielding members of the UN Security Council, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China. In Texas, President Bush was asked about the offer to Iran.
And so we will see if the Iranians take our offer seriously. The choice is theirs to make. I have said the United States will come and sit down at the table with them so long as they are willing to suspend their enrichment in a verifiable way. So that sounds like a positive response to me. Steve.
In Iraq, almost 600 prisoners were released from jails across the country today. The Iraqi government says a total of 2,500 people will be released as a gesture of national reconciliation. An estimated 28,000 people remain imprisoned in Iraqi jails. Just over half are believed to be detained by U.S. troops. In Britain, a military court has found three British soldiers not guilty in the drowning death of a 15-year-old Iraqi teen. The soldiers were accused of forcing four Iraqis to swim across a canal by threatening to shoot them. The 15-year-old, Ahmed Jaber Karim, did not know how to swim. In a statement, the British Defense Ministry said the soldiers have the Army's full support to continue their military careers. Meanwhile, a U.S. Army officer has announced he's refusing his deployment to Iraq, slated for later this month. The officer, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, says he first asked for permission to resign his post in January. He says he wrote, quote, "I'm wholeheartedly opposed to the continued war in Iraq, the deception used to wage this war, and the lawlessness that's pervaded every aspect of our civilian leadership." Lieutenant Watada is one of the first commissioned officers to refuse deployment. Simultaneous news conferences will be held by his supporters today in his home state of Hawaii and in Washington state. Military officials told Watada he cannot attend the news conference because he's barred from speaking publicly about his case during duty hours. USA Today is reporting the Pentagon is resisting efforts by military doctors to track the number of concussions suffered by combat troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The doctors say thousands of troops are risking permanent brain damage by returning to combat with undiagnosed concussions. An estimated 20% of troops in frontline infantry units have suffered from the concussions. According to USA Today, the Brain Injury Center wants the Pentagon to use a screening procedure to identify possibly dangerous concussions, but the Pentagon has declined. Angela Drake, a neuropsychologist with the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center, said, quote, "I think they're afraid. The sheer numbers are overwhelming. This is a worrisome thing. It's like opening a can of worms," she said. In Canada, 15 of the 17 terror suspects nabbed in a sting operation last week appeared in court for a bail hearing on Tuesday. The suspects are accused of plotting attacks inside Canada. The alleged plots included a raid on the Canadian Parliament and beheading government officials, including Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Prosecutors said the suspects planned the attacks to call for the defense of Muslim prisoners. A lawyer for one of the suspects denied the allegations his client planned to carry out the beheadings. The Toronto Star is reporting one of the suspects is a former Canadian soldier who received more than 4 years of military training. Lawyers for other suspects complained Tuesday they're being denied access to their clients. Canadian officials say more arrests are likely. Here in the United States, 8 states held primaries Tuesday in one of the day's most watched races. Republican Brian Bilbray narrowly won the seat vacated by jailed former Congressmember Randy Duke Cunningham in San Diego. California State Treasurer Phil Angelides won the Democratic primary to take on Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in November. And in a race we covered on Tuesday on Democracy Now!, incumbent Congressmember Jane Harman beat out anti-war candidate Marcy Winograd in the Democratic primary in California's 36th district. Winograd defied expectations and captured nearly 38% of the vote. Europe's leading human rights watchdog has determined that 14 European countries have been involved in or complicit in secret CIA operations since the September 11th attacks. Dick Marty, chair of the Council of Europe's Committee on Legal Affairs and Human Rights, accused the Bush administration of adopting a legal approach which is, quote, utterly alien to the European tradition. Marty's investigation focused on the U.S. practice of extraordinary rendition, where CIA officials kidnap individuals and then transport them to other countries for interrogation. According to the report, Spain, Turkey, Germany, and Cyprus provided staging posts for rendition operations. Italy, Sweden, Bosnia, and Macedonia all allowed the rendition of residents from their soil. Britain, Ireland, Portugal, and Greece all provided airports used by the CIA. And Romania and Poland allowed the CIA to operate secret prisons on their soil. A top Justice Department official testified Tuesday before Congress that the federal government has the authority to prosecute and jail journalists who disclose classified information. Matthew Friedrich, who heads the criminal division of the Justice Department, reiterated a statement made recently by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Friedrich claimed that reporters are not exempt from the Espionage Act of 1917. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter questioned the Justice Department's claim and said, quote, it's highly doubtful in my mind that was ever the intent of Congress. Friedrich was called to testify on why the FBI was trying to review the papers of the late investigative journalist Jack Anderson. But Friedrich refused to comment on the case. At one point, Senator Patrick Leahy asked, quote, are there any questions you guys are allowed to answer other than your title and time of day? The American Civil Liberties Union is calling on the Federal Communications Commission to hold off approving the merger of telecom giants AT&T and Bell South until the FCC investigates the company's role in the government's domestic spy programs. Last month, USA Today revealed that the AT&T Bell South, as well as Verizon, provided National Security Agency with the phone call records of tens of millions of Americans. In Louisiana, Democratic Governor Kathleen Blanco has announced she will sign a bill to ban nearly all abortions in the state, even in cases of rape or incest. The bill, however, would go into effect only if the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision establishing a constitutional right to abortion. Under the law, any person who performed or aided in an abortion could face up to 10 years in prison and a fine of up to $100,000. In Vermont, two peace activists were arrested Monday for disrupting a commencement address given by National Intelligence Director John Negroponte at St. Johnsbury Academy. Moments after Negroponte began his address, a protester stood up and yelled, "In the name of democracy, I object to this man speaking. He has blood on his hands from his work in Central America and Iraq. He shouldn't be at the podium. He should be in jail. He's a war criminal." As the protester was being escorted away, Negroponte said, quote, now it's my turn. But before he could continue, another protester stood up and accused Negroponte of overseeing torture, killings, and rape in Honduras when he was ambassador. In Brazil, more than 1,000 landless rural workers stormed the country's lower house of Congress and temporarily took over part of the building. The workers were demanding more funds and legislative reform to accelerate agrarian reform. Officials said 20 people were hurt as protesters fought with security forces and destroyed government property. On Capitol Hill, Republican Senator Arlen Specter has announced he will not subpoena phone company executives to talk about their roles in the National Security Agency's domestic spy program. Specter's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. On Tuesday, he said he agreed to put off the subpoenas after the White House offered to cooperate with his legislation that would seek a federal review of the surveillance program. Specter said he couldn't make the executives talk because a company lawyer and Vice President Dick Cheney said they could not discuss classified information. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy responded, quote, "Why don't we just recess for the rest of the year? Vice President Cheney will just tell the nation what laws we'll have," Leahy said. In other news from Capitol Hill, the Senate scheduled to vote today on an amendment to ban same-sex marriage. President Bush is lobbying Congress to support the measure. Analysts expect the amendment to fail to attract enough support to clear the Senate floor. And in a story we've been following here in New York, Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau has subpoenaed records of the Pinnacle Group, LLC. A huge Manhattan landlord, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez has been investigating in the New York Daily News. His reports show the Pinnacle Group has driven out hundreds of tenants, has systematically abused tenants in gentrifying neighborhoods and illegally driving up rents. And newly released CIA documents have provided fresh details of the U.S. government's lax and at times cooperative attitude toward Nazis after the Second World War. According to the New York Times, the CIA learned the pseudonym and whereabouts of the fugitive Holocaust administrator Adolf Eichmann in 1958, but took no action. Eichmann helped implement the policy of extermination that killed millions of people, mostly Jews. 2 years after the CIA found out he was in Argentina, Eichmann was kidnapped by Israeli agents. He was tried and executed in Jerusalem in 1962. The documents also reveal the CIA successfully lobbied Life magazine to delete a reference to former Nazi government official who went on to serve in the West German government. The reference appeared in Eichmann's memoirs, which Life magazine published in 1960. The CIA made the request on behalf of the German government, which did not want the official's role to become publicly known. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The family of an Iraqi man killed by American forces in the town of Hammamdia in Iraq in April has approved his exhumation as part of a U.S. military investigation into his death. Investigators believe the killing of Hashim Ibrahim Awad was planned by a small group of Marines who shot him, then planted a shovel and an AK-47 rifle at the scene. This according to a senior Pentagon official. This in the Associated Press. The official told AP that the AK-47 and the shovel, which were taken from another home before the shooting, were meant to make it look like the man had been digging a hole for a roadside bomb and was killed in an exchange of gunfire. Hashim Awad was in his 50s with a lame leg and bad eyesight. His family told The Washington Post that a small group of U.S. servicemen came to them last week and offered the family money in exchange for supporting the Marines' version of the killing. Seven Marines and a Navy medical corpsman are being held in the brig at California's Camp Pendleton in connection with the probe. Four other Marines have been confined to base. A source familiar with the investigation told CNN last week that murder charges were likely against the Marines. Meanwhile, friends of Hashim Awad told Knight Ridder that U.S. Marines had approached him several times asking him to be an informant. He refused every time. For more on the story, we go to Baghdad to speak with Nancy Youssef, the Baghdad bureau chief for Knight Ridder. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Nancy.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us the latest on this killing in Hammamdia?
Sure. We are hearing conflicting reports about whether the body has been exhumed. The family told us that they agreed to that, which was interesting because some consider that un-Islamic. Here it's starting to get some more reaction as residents are learning about the circumstances of the incident, and the investigation remains open in Camp Pendleton.
Nancy, why don't we go through the story again? Knight Ridder has been following this very closely. Tell us what happened in April and what you understand from conversations, for example, with the brother of the man and others.
Sure. In fact, yeah, we were the first to talk to the family, and it took a little bit of time because the military misspelled the name of the town. So once we found it, it's a very small town. It's right next to El Grave. It's just north of the prison. And the family there said that on the night of April 26th, Marines were knocking door to door and asking for various things. And as it turns out, all the doors that they knocked to were friends or relatives of Hashem's. At the first house, they knocked, and it was a very sort of gentle knock, according to one of Hashem's brothers. And he thought, well, they're not here to raid me, so I'm not going to go answer the door, and maybe they'll go away. And he was surprised when they did. He looked out the window, and he saw them go to another house of a friend of his named Muhammad. And Muhammad said that they knocked at the door, and his mother answered. And they asked his mother, are there any men here? And she said, no. And they left. And then the brother saw them go from Muhammad's house to another relative's house, Farhan. And Farhan said that they came to his house, and they told them that they were conducting a raid. And they went to the house, and there was a shovel leaning against the front of his house, and they took it. And they asked him if he had any weapons, and he said, I have an AK-47, and they took that from him. And he didn't think anything of it. He thought maybe they suspected that someone would use this shovel and AK-47 on an act against them. And he said he thought to himself, in the morning, I'll approach the first patrol I see and get my AK-47 and shovel back, not knowing what the family said happened next. After they left Farhan's house, the family said they went to Hashim's house. And his brother, Awad, the same brother who's been looking out the window the whole time, sees them go to Hashim's house, knock on the door, and he sees the same group of six or seven soldiers at the house. He sees two of them, one grab each hand and pull Hashim out. And he said he didn't think anything of it because he thought maybe they would question him and for a few hours, maybe detain him for a few days, but ultimately they would find nothing on him and he'd be released. And so this goes on, and the next morning, this is all in the middle of the night, and the next morning he gets up and he goes to Hashim's house and he thought he better tell the family that his brother, that Hashim has been detained in case they didn't know since this happened in the middle of the night. They did know and they were looking for him. And then Awad said he went to work at a gas station, at a petrol station, and some police came, pulled in, and they said the Americans brought this body to our station. And he was killed in your area. Would you mind looking at him to see if you can identify him? And he saw the body and the shovel and the AK-47, and he said, I recognized him, but I just couldn't put it together. His face was so swollen. And it really nagged at him, he said. And so then he went to the hospital later on that day after Farhan told him about the AK-47 and the shovel that was taken. And he put it all together finally and said he discovered it was his brother. And since that time, he says he has been harassed by investigators coming to his house. The investigation started because a few days after this incident, allegedly on April 26th, there was a community meeting, and the word of this, of course, had spread because it's a small town. And the local tribal leaders came and said to the Marines, the Sam was wrongly killed, and they opened an investigation. And so since that time, Awad and his brothers say that they've been harassed by Marines, that they get knocked in the middle of the night. At one point, they said they were taken to Abu Ghraib by the military and questioned and then driven back in a military convoy. And they said that they agreed to let his body be exhumed because they want to do anything they can to basically get justice out of this case.
We're talking to Nancy Youssef, Baghdad Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder. The family showed you a signed statement by a U.S. soldier, by a Marine?
Yes, that's right. When the body came to the police station, when Awad went to the gas station to his job and the police and everything was put together, the police said to him, by the way, when they brought the body, we had this statement as well. And a few days after that, there were flyers posted in Arabic around Hamdouniya that said that the Marines admitting that they had killed Hashem because he was planning an IED and because he was a suspected terrorist and because when things like this happen, they must respond with lethal force.
Where are you going? How are you following the story now, Nancy Youssef, finally?
Well, really, the story's moved to the U.S. What was interesting to me is when we were trying to find this man, we kept asking people before we knew the town exactly where it was. We kept asking people, this man in Anbar, near Anbar, who was killed by the Americans, do you know him? And the response over and over and over again was, one man, that happens every day. That happens every day. So for me, I think it's really just trying to capture that feeling and the implications of that sentiment. I think a lot of people here are looking to this investigation. There's a lot of pessimism that this will lead to any serious charges for the Marines involved, either in this case or Haditha. And I don't think people are really holding their breath here for murder charges. And so we're really watching that reaction. And as the story gets momentum over in the U.S., it's sort of now having a change in Iraq.
Nancy Youssef, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Baghdad Bureau Chief of Knight Ridder. When we come back, we look at the military cover-up of the Haditha killings with one of the reporters that has been breaking the story, Parashim Ghosh of Time. Stay with us.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
War Pigs by Black Sabbath here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Newsweek is reporting, well, let me quote their first paragraph. The Marines know how to get psyched up for a big fight. In November 2004, before the Battle of Fallujah, the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, better known as the 3-1 or Thundering 3rd, held a chariot race. Horses had been confiscated from suspected insurgents, and charioteers were urged to go all out. The men of Kilo Company, honored to be first into the city on the day of the battle, wore togas and cardboard helmets and hoisted a shield emblazoned with a large K. As speakers blasted a heavy metal song, Come On, Feel the Noise, the warriors of Kilo Company carried a homemade mace and a ball and chain studded with M16 bullets. A company captain intoned a line from a scene in the movie Gladiator, in which the Romans prepare to slaughter the barbarians. What you do here echoes in eternity, that from an article in this week's issue of Newsweek magazine. The article goes on to say Kilo Company arrived in Haditha in the fall of 2005. Meanwhile, the Senate Armed Services Committee is planning to hold hearings soon into the alleged massacre and cover-up of 24 unarmed Iraqis by U.S. Marines in Haditha last November. In a letter to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, the Republican chair of the committee, John Warner, wrote that delaying the results of the investigation will mean that, quote, a mixture of information, misinformation, and unconfirmed facts will continue to spiral in the public domain. Warner said the first witness called would likely be Major General Eldon Bargewell, the Army general who's conducting one of two investigations into the alleged massacre. Congressional aides told the Associated Press Bargewell's report could be completed within the week, but that the military's separate criminal investigation is not expected to be finished anytime soon. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Susan Collins said Rumsfeld should be brought to account. She said the Armed Services Committee must, quote, ask hard questions such as, when did Secretary Rumsfeld learn of the allegations and what action did he take? The killings took place on November 19th after a roadside bomb struck a Humvee in the western town of Haditha, killing one Marine. The next day, the Marines said in a statement 15 Iraqi civilians died in the initial blast and that eight others were killed when Marines returned insurgent fire. But eyewitnesses contradict this account. They say the men, women, and children were killed when Marines burst into their houses after the blast and shot them dead in their nightclothes. Early this year, a videotape of the aftermath of the attack showing the bodies of women and children was obtained by Time magazine. The video verified the eyewitness accounts and prompted an investigation by the military. Over the past week, more details have emerged about what took place in Haditha, and a military probe has uncovered evidence that implicates both Marines and commanders in a cover-up of the killings. For more, we go to London to Aparashim Ghosh, chief international correspondent for Time magazine, one of the reporters who broke the story. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you with us. When we had you in Democracy Now! Studios, you first described this story to us several months ago. Now, can you talk about the latest you know about the cover-up?
Well, there is, as you pointed out, an investigation specifically into that aspect of this very sorry story, and we are hoping there will be a report out soon. What I can say definitively is that the Marines' first report of the incident was a total fabrication. And when we called that bluff, when we informed them that we had information, otherwise they were very hostile towards us. They accused us of buying into enemy propaganda. So already at that early stage, it would appear that there was an effort to, at the very least, deflect our attention. It's hard to know until this investigation comes up who exactly was involved, how far up it went, and who will be implicated. But let me just say this: it would not surprise me if it went quite high indeed.
What happened when Time started bringing these allegations to the military, and then what happened when you show them the videotape?
Well, when we first, as I said, we first approached the Marines when we saw the videotape and we'd spoken to some of the survivors and eyewitnesses, and we basically said that the original report you put out doesn't seem to add up, that's when they accused us of buying into Al Qaeda propaganda. When we got no real response from the Marines, we took the videotape and some of our investigations to a higher authority, the highest public affairs officer in Baghdad, and he took a look at it. He seemed to agree with us that this was something that deserved closer attention, and he brought it to the attention of his superiors, and that is when investigations began. There have been three separate investigations into the incident. The first was by an army colonel early on, and then there have been two others, and we're waiting for the investigation reports on those.
General Bargewell will report Marine commanders knew within a few days of the Haditha incident that the military account wasn't true.
I would not be surprised if that was the case. It was very clear from the evidence that we saw on the video that these people could not have been killed by the roadside bomb. There was extensive damage inside their homes, which would not have happened with a roadside bomb. There was very little structural damage outside their homes. It was clear that these people had been shot dead with bullets rather than killed by shrapnel from a bomb. So it was quite obvious to us that the original report, at the very least, was not in fact true.
In your report in Time, you say in addition to the videotape that you showed the military and photos taken on the day of the attack, there may be surveillance tape from a military drone in the area.
That is what we're hearing. That there is. It's hard to know just how much you can get from one of these drones. I have previously seen pictures from drones that are incredibly detailed and would help an investigation, but I've also seen pictures that are quite hard to and murky to make out. That is for the investigators. I hope for the sake of clarity and that they do get very clear pictures.
You also report that Army investigators visited the scene of the massacre at least 15 times?
That is correct. We spoke to the spokesman of the victims and their families, and he told us, and this is worth mentioning, that they were very impressed with the thoroughness of the investigation. He said the investigators had visited the site at least 15 times. They had asked lots of very detailed questions. They had done mock-ups using models. The survivors and residents of that street were quite impressed with the thoroughness of the investigation.
And that's Sergeant Frank Wuderich, the officer in charge of the unit that day. Investigators have placed him at least at two of the houses where the Marines killed the Iraqis. He hasn't been relieved of his duties?
That is the information we have at the moment, yes.
Marine officials reporting they receive an average of one complaint a day from Iraqis about U.S. missions, so-called gone wrong?
Yes, that's not surprising. We ourselves in our office receive lots of these. It has to be said that the vast majority of these are sort of hard to believe, and some of them are just plainly lies. And so we have quite a high... We have very, very sensitive antennae for this sort of thing, and I'm sure the military does as well.
Aparashim Ghosh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Chief International Correspondent for Time Magazine, has spent the last 3.5 years in Iraq, reporting to us today from London. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime, Annie.
As we turn now to look at the media coverage of the war, the Bush administration, and other issues that have or should have made headlines during the last 6 years, journalist Eric Bowler argues in his new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, that the mainstream media essentially gave up its role as defenders of the public interest and instead succumbed to pressure from the Bush White House and the conservative right. Eric Bullitt writes that the reasons for this were many, including, quote, consolidated media landscape in which owners were increasingly, almost exclusively, multinational corporations, the same corporations anxious to win approval from the Republican-controlled federal government to allow for even further ownership consolidation. The press timidity was also fueled by the Republicans' tight grip on Congress and the mainstream media's natural tendency to revere Beltway power. The timidity was also driven by Beltway careerism, by media insiders who understood that despite the cliche about the liberal media, advancement to senior positions was actually made doubly difficult for anyone with a reputation for being too far left or too caustic towards Republicans. Bowler argues the administration used a variety of tactics to undermine and control the press, including, well, let's ask him. He joins us in the studio here. Eric Bowler, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What were these tactics?
Well, I think the Bush administration came in with a very clear sort of pushback agenda versus the press. They really broke with modern tradition that the press was going to sort of act as a public interest and act behalf on the public. Bush was going to essentially walk away from press conferences, for instance. The fewest press conferences of any president in modern history. And they didn't even really feign interest in having sort of an open dialogue with the press. There was all sorts of restrictions on the information. There were sort of veiled threats about, in terms of reporters early on who showed that they were going to be sort of aggressive. White House spokesman Ari Fleischman, famously noted that one sort of tough question at a White House briefing had been noted in the building. That sort of set the tone early on, and I think they just continued with this sort of pushback agenda against the press.
You talk about the close personal relationship between reporters and the people they cover.
Right.
Name some names.
Well, I point out in the book that's not new. I mean, you know, Ben Bradley, when he was the editor of the Washington Post, was John F. Kennedy's neighbor and close confidant for years. So that's been going on inside the Beltway for a long time. But I think recently the titanic shift in terms of how the press has dealt with this White House compared to the last one, I thought maybe it offered some clues as to sort of this shrieking timidity. I looked at, for instance, Ted Koppel and former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Good friends, you know, they don't really talk about it, but if you're in the Beltway, you know from sort of these roast dinners that they're very good friends, they hang out together, which is interesting. But then I went back and looked after Colin Powell gave his famous UN presentation right before the war, a presentation that has been sort of even dismissed by him as sort of a fiasco and embarrassment. A year after that, he gave three sit-down exclusive interviews with Ted Koppel. His presentation to the UN literally never came up. I mean, Ted Koppel asked him 60 questions over three exclusive interviews, and they simply did not talk about what was Colin Powell's most embarrassing episode. Bob Schieffer was a good friend of President Bush. Bob Schieffer's brother was a former business partner with President Bush.
He got
exclusive interviews when Bush was governor. Bob Schieffer talked about in his book the history of Face the Nation, how proud he was of an interview Bush gave Face the Nation during the New Hampshire primaries. It was almost sort of like a father-son relationship.
This is particularly interesting, given that Dan Rather was forced out of his position as anchor, and Schieffer replaced him.
When Dan Rather was forced out, the head of CBS announced, you know, the White House, you know, doesn't hate CBS anymore because they have Bob Schieffer in the anchor chair. I mean, that's not to say Bob Schieffer isn't a professional journalist and doesn't do a relatively decent job, but he's very close with the Bush administration, and I think it sort of gives some... It offers some signs as to explain this really bizarre behavior that we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years.
Other journalists?
Who else do I talk about? Well, Tim Russert is famous for his closeness with the sort of the Rumsfelds and the Cheneys. He had exclusive access, almost exclusive access, to Dick Cheney for the first 4 years in terms of Meet the Press.
Well, you know, you talk about him being famous for this and all these different journalists and relationships. Most people in this country know nothing about this.
As I point out in the book, I mean, if you're not part of the Beltway culture, if you don't follow it professionally, you don't know that these people are all sort of having cocktails and hanging out and buddy-buddy.
Well, talk about this, because you point out in the book the whole interaction and the debate between John Edwards and Dick Cheney, the vice presidential debate.
Right. It was one of the famous moments from the vice presidential debate. Dick Cheney, his big one-liner that night was this: when John Kerry walked onto the debate stage, Edwards walked onto the debate stage, Dick Cheney said, "This is the first time I've ever met you." And the clear implication was that Edwards was a, you know, total newcomer, wasn't up to the vice president's for the job. But he learned almost immediately after the debate they had met three previous times, and one of the times was on Meet the Press. But right after the debate, Tim Russert goes on TV and talks about the debate and talks about this put-down that Cheney had unleashed on Edwards, and never explains that they met on his show. And he knew they met on his show, and he just sort of played dumb all night while people talked about Dick Cheney's sort of devastating put-down. It just doesn't make any sense. If you know that, why don't you talk about it? And again, at the time, Russert had incredibly good access to Dick Cheney in the White House, so maybe that explains why he sort of looked the other way.
You also write about Gwen Ifill and Condoleezza Rice.
Right. They're good friends. Condoleezza Rice had a function that talked about how they had dinner together, and Gwen Ifill was such a great cook. And this was right at the time when Condoleezza Rice got in trouble for not being up to speed, not reading an entire NIE report. This was the whole Joe Wilson aluminum tubes from Africa. And her explanation at the time was, well, I didn't read the whole report. But within weeks, she had told Gwen Ifill two completely different explanations. But Gwen Ifill didn't ask her the obvious follow-up question: did you read the report or did you not? And again, the fact that they're buddies and have a close social friendship, maybe it explains it. I don't know what else explains the sort of timidity that we've seen.
Eric Bohler, you most recently wrote about Wen Ho Lee and the settlement that's gotten almost no attention. Can you briefly explain the significance of this, for people who don't even know what the case was about?
Wen Ho Lee was charged with being essentially a spy for the Chinese, and the case was brought
front. Los Alamos scientists.
Right, Los Alamos scientists. This was in 1999. It was brought front and center by the New York Times, who went overboard, incredibly aggressive coverage about how he had stolen the crown jewels and et cetera, et cetera. The case crumbled. One of the charges was thrown out. The federal judge apologized to Wen Ho Lee on behalf of the government, completely railroaded.
He had been held in
solitary confinement for almost a year
in New Mexico.
And so he filed a civil suit. He was trying to find out who from the government leaked to the press about him being a target, personal information about him, and his lawyers wanted to go to the reporters and find out. It was another one of these sort of showdowns over subpoenas, and eventually last week, five major news organizations settled with the government, hand in hand with the government, and agreed to pay Wenho Li $1.6 million. Unprecedented, A, for any media company to pay a lawsuit like this to go away in terms of First Amendment, and also unprecedented to team up with the government. But as I wrote, it was only fitting since they had teamed up to smear him in 99. So it was fitting that they teamed up to sort of make the whole thing go away.
We're talking to Eric Bollert. His new book is called Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. You also talk about the Valerie Plame case,
right,
and the what you describe as just a serious abrogation of the media to cover this while the government investigated.
It's the most serious, it's become the most serious criminal investigation of the Bush administration. And if you look at when the story first broke in September of 2003, when the Washington Post found out there had been this coordinated effort to smear Joe Wilson by putting out word that his wife worked at the CIA, until the time Scooter Libby was indicted in October 2005, 2 years, the coverage there wasn't what it should have been, and certainly wasn't what the press had given criminal investigations during the Clinton years, investigations that most oftentimes went nowhere. For instance, I looked at the network news, signature network news program, 60 Minutes, 60 Minutes 2, Nightline, 2020, Primetime Live. 2 years, those shows total were on, aired almost 400 episodes. There was not one news report on the Valerie Plame investigation. And I looked at Nightline, which is obviously on much more often. 2 years, they did three segments on the Valerie Plame investigation. Compared to the first 2 years of Whitewater, they did 19 programs on an investigation that we all know went nowhere. Clearly a double standard in terms of the seriousness which they showed for a criminal investigation, which still haunts the administration.
And in this case, you had the reporters themselves, the key players in this.
Oh, yeah. And so that's the other angle. I opened the book, really, with Bob Woodward, with his infamous sitting on the scoop that he also had gotten this leak about Valerie Plame. Waits until after Scooter Libby is indicted to make this stunning announcement that he had also, he was part of this leak. Never said anything for 2 years, said it wasn't important, said it was trivial. But he did go on TV to sort of denigrate the whole investigation. I mean, this is a guy.
Didn't he call the prosecutor a junkyard dog?
Junkyard prosecutor, and said essentially it was a waste of time, and this sort of information swapping happens all the time. This is the guy, you know, talk about from watchdog to lab. I mean, Bob Woodward, of all people, with his Watergate background. But all the other reporters, you know, the argument was, well, it was a confidential leak. You have to protect your sources. You don't necessarily have to protect sources if they're lying and doing it anonymously and doing it to score political points. I don't think reporters have to go to the deck to protect people who are just using them. And again, Tim Russert, the reporters at Time Magazine, they could have made noise during 2004. They knew important information. But they sat on it all through the 2004 election, and it was only after that the special prosecutor, what I point out in my book, and you mentioned, the special prosecutor essentially did the job of what reporters used to do, even without his subpoena power. He was the one asking questions that reporters absolutely did want, for 2 years, did not want to know anything about.
Eric Bollert, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
His book
is called Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. Stay with us.
One of many zeros kicked around.
Coffee and TV by Blur here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined on the telephone by Thomas Friedman. He's the foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times, three-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Thomas Friedman's one of the country's most widely read political commentators. His books include the award-winning From Beirut to Jerusalem and The Lexus and the Olive Tree. His latest book is The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Later this month, he'll host Addicted to Oil, Thomas Friedman Reporting, a television special on the politics of this country's reliance on oil, or what he calls petropolitics. Addicted to Oil airs on the Discovery Channel on June 24th. Can you talk about the film? Thomas Friedman.
Thanks for having me. The basic thrust of the film is that this is not your parents' energy crisis. That we're in a totally new world for four basic reasons. The first is that we're in a war on terrorism today in which we're funding both sides in the war with our energy purchases. We fund the U.S. Army, Navy, and Marine Corps with our tax dollars. We fund al-Qaeda, Islamic Jihad, and the regimes that support them and charities that support them indirectly with our energy purchases. So we're funding both sides in the war on terrorism, and that's flat-out nuts. Second, the world is flat, I believe, and 3 billion new consumers just walked onto the playing field from India, China, Brazil, the former Soviet Union, all with their own version of the American dream, a house, a car, a toaster, a microwave, and a refrigerator. If we don't find an alternative way to satisfy their energy needs and demands, we're going to see this planet burned up, choked up, and smoked up so much faster than people realize. And that leads really to the third reason this is not your parents' energy crisis, which is that green technology, clean power, this is going to be the growth industry of the 21st century to satisfy all these new consumers. And we want America to be a dominant player in that industry. And the way we get America to be a dominant player in that clean power industry is not by telling our automakers, our industrialists, oh, don't toughen up your standards on energy and fuel efficiency. We don't want you to do anything hard. That's precisely what will lead to China, Japan, and Europe taking the lead in that industry. Number four, the reason this is not your parents' energy crisis is that we thought the fall of the Berlin Wall was going to be unleashing an unstoppable tide of free markets and free people. And for about 10 years, it did just that. But basically, that 10 years was coincident with oil at $20 to $40 a barrel. As oil has moved to $40 to $70 a barrel of oil, we've seen the tide of free markets and free people unleashed by the fall of the Berlin Wall meeting a counter tide of what I would call petro-authoritarianism. These are authoritarian regimes, some of them elected authoritarians, like in Venezuela, who are using their huge oil windfalls now to ensconce their authoritarianism in power. So what are we seeing in the world today? The wave of free markets and free people that was unleashed by the fall of the Berlin Wall is now meeting a counterwave of petro-authoritarianism by petrol estates called Russia, Iran, Sudan, Venezuela, Kazakhstan, Equatorial Guinea. You can go down the list. And they're creating a very poisonous geopolitics.
Thomas Friedman, on the subject of oil, I wanted to ask you about Iraq. I'm sure many of your critics will be happy to hear you continuing to speak out about this country's reliance on oil. But you've also been a vocal supporter of the war in Iraq, and many critics argue that the Bush administration wouldn't have taken this country to war if Iraq's main export was olive oil, not crude. How does your support for easing off our reliance on oil reconcile with your support for the war in Iraq?
Well, if you read, watch my documentary or read everything I've said, I've been actually calling for this kind of oil policy ever since 9/11. And I believe it's the only way to advance the cause, or it's one of the only ways to advance the cause of freedom in that part of the world. As you know, if you've been reading me on Iraq, my position on the war had nothing to do with WMD. My position on the war had to do with the fact that we've got a part of the world over there that is basically entrenched in a whole set of pathologies that produce the kind of characters that produced 9/11, who I think in the long term pose a real fundamental threat to open societies all over the world, including ours. And the only way to get at those pathologies, okay, is by trying to produce a different context in that part of the world. That was my argument in favor of the war. To me, it was to try to partner with people there to produce a different politics. And I believed, going back to before the war, going back to 9/11, part of that policy has to be a different energy politics in our country as well.
Well, as you say, you didn't argue that this was to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. You said it was to spread democracy. In November of 2003, you wrote, quote, This war is the most important liberal, revolutionary U.S. democracy-building project since the Marshall Plan. We got off to an unnecessarily bad start, but it's one of the noblest things this country has ever attempted abroad, and it's a moral and strategic imperative that we give it our best shot. Those were your words.
Right.
Critics of the position say if the U.S. came to Iraq to build democracy, then it wouldn't have vigorously resisted Iraqi calls for direct elections. Now, as you'll recall, in January 2004, 100,000 Iraqis took to the streets chanting yes to elections, no to selections. Elections were finally held in January of 2005 after the Bush administration fought to delay them. The Bush administration has also ignored overwhelming Iraqi public opinion in favor of a timetable for troop withdrawal. I think it's 70%, according to a Zogby poll this past January. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a very good and legitimate question, and if you've been reading me on the war, from the very beginning, I've been a critic of how we have prosecuted this. You know, it's possible to do a good thing really, really badly. The very first column I wrote from Iraq, and I've been there five times, was called Hold Your Applause, okay? Because I could see, A, we didn't have enough troops there, and B, I've been an advocate of, you know, elections there from very early on and turning authority over to Iraqis as fast as we could. We did many, many stupid things there, and we may have done so many stupid things that now we've dug ourselves in a hole we can't get out of. I hope not, because at the end of the day, elections were held. 8 million Iraqis did turn out. Now Iraq is going to be what Iraqis make of it, and I would also point you to the fact that if we lose in Iraq, I wish we could say we were losing to the Viet Cong, you know, traditional Iraqi nationalists, but we're not. We're losing to Islamofascists. We're losing to sectarian fanatics. We're losing to criminal gangs. And we're losing in part, as you say, because we never established a secure context from the very beginning. But I've been focused from the very beginning on trying to do this right so we had a chance for those Democrats to emerge.
Let me ask you about Israel and the Palestinians.
Sure.
You've covered this issue for a very long time. Since the outbreak of the Second Intifada in the fall of 2000, you've laid most of the blame for the breakdown of the peace process in the Palestinians. You said the Palestinian leadership has chosen violence instead of accepting the generous Israeli peace offer at Camp David in July 2000 and the months after. But Palestinians have long maintained that Israel has never offered them anything beyond a Bantustan state carved up by the large Israeli settlement blocks. In fact, on Democracy Now!, we had the former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, on, and he said that if he were a Palestinian, he would have rejected the offer his government offered Arafat at Camp David. Your response to this, and what do you say to Palestinians who say they can't accept a peace deal that would leave tens of thousands of settlers deep in their territory?
A very legitimate question. Again, if you read my columns on this, you know, all the way through, what you'll see, the argument I basically have been making was this. I understood why Yasser Arafat did not accept the Camp David offer, okay? Because my position, which has always been for a two-state solution along the 67 lines, okay, I understood why Palestinians would say, very nice of you, Mr. Barak, to offer us 90%, okay? But we believe we're entitled to 100%. That's what Sadat got, okay? That's what we believe we're entitled to. I totally get that. That is absolutely a defensible position. But here's what's indefensible. What's indefensible is in response to a 90% offer instead of a 100% offer, you go on a rampage of suicide bombing and intifada rather than saying, to Barak. Arafat could have said to Barak, you know, Mr. Barak, that offer, it's part the way there. I'm really glad to see you've moved from 50 to 90, but you're still short. But here's what I want to do. I want to go around and convince every Israeli why it's in their fundamental interest, now that you've gone to 90, to go from 90 to 100. I want to make that argument directly to the Israeli people. That is not what Yasser Arafat did. What he launched instead was a violent intifada. That is what I found inexcusable.
I thought what Yasser Arafat said was he wanted UN 242, complete withdrawal.
What Yasser Arafat did was launch an intifada.
Well, let me ask you about a comment you made in April 1988 in the interview with the Israeli press. You were talking about what Israel should do with the occupied territories, and you said Israel should hand over control to a client Palestinian proxy force. You explain this by saying, quote, I believe that as soon as Ahmed has a seat in the bus, he will limit his demands. MIT professor Noam Chomsky later reprinted this statement in his articles and books. He called your comments racist. How do you respond?
If I have said that in 1988, 20 years ago, I would have absolutely no recollection of saying that or what the context was. But if he said I said that, then I said that. I've said a million things differently since. And if you want to go back and check every quote Noam Chomsky has made over the last 30 years and pluck out one from 1988 and throw it in his face, go right ahead.
So you're saying you're sorry you said that.
100,000 words since then, okay?
And so, but you're saying you're sorry you said that.
My 100,000 words since then have been very, very clear. Before then and after then, I have no idea what the context is you're talking about.
Well, let me...
100,000 words since then have been very clear. I'm for a two-state solution.
Last July, you wrote a controversial column calling on the State Department to monitor and publicly identify excuse makers and hate mongers.
Yes.
You wrote, quote, "After every major terrorist incident, the excuse makers come out to tell us why imperialism, Zionism, colonialism, or Iraq explains why the terrorist acted. These excuse makers are just one notch less despicable than the terrorists and also deserve to be exposed. Every quarter, the State Department should identify the top 10 hate mongers, excuse makers, and truth tellers in the world." That's your quote.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that.
To make an enemies list, a State Department?
I believe people who make excuses for terrorism should be exposed and identified. I also have used my own pen to expose and identify people in Israel who expose hate mongering as well toward Palestinians among the settlers. I've been probably one of their biggest critics and enemies in the New York Times, referring to them as fanatics and lunatics.
For people who say we have to understand why others in the world are angry, do you think they belong on the State Department list?
Understanding why people are angry and understanding why people go out and tell you that 9/11 happened because and no Jews were in the Twin Towers at that time because they were all warned ahead of time. So, you know, let's be clear about what I was saying. I was very focused on people who want to justify the murder of innocent women and children, innocent civilians, and I very much believe then, and I very much believe now, they should be exposed. I think Jewish hate mongers should be exposed as well, as I believe I made clear in that column, too.
Are you concerned today in this country about people who are fiercely critical of the war in Iraq, the occupation, being called unpatriotic, being called hate mongers, being put on government lists?
Amy, if you read my column, one of the biggest critics in the war is the woman I live with. I probably, you know, mentioned, I don't know how many times in my column, my wife's criticism of the war. I believe it's honorable. I believe it's a perfectly moral position. I would be disgusted by anyone calling them, you know, traitors.
And why do you trust the State Department to make the determination on who they would call terrorists for being critical of the invasion?
I didn't say calling them terrorists. We clearly know what hate speech is, and we know what legitimate opposition is. I know the difference.
And do you think the State Department knows the difference, the Bush administration, President Bush?
I think they could. I know the difference between hate speech and people who oppose a policy on legitimate grounds. And opposing the Iraq war is not hate speech. I'm sorry. Basically justifying the bombing of the World Trade Center is hate speech. I know the difference. If you don't, that's your problem.
Do you think the State Department does?
I'm not going to get into this silliness.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Thomas Friedman, three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, New York Times columnist. Thank you for being with us. His latest book is The World is Flat. This is Democracy Now! For a transcript, for audio and video podcast of today's program, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, to Megan Whitney, to Samantha Chamblee. You can go to our website and also sign up for our daily digest emails that give you the headlines and our special segments, as well as further contact information and links to our guests and other stories that we are covering. That's democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.